the countless tomes of imperial history, the origins of the Emperor remain obscured by time, secrecy, and deliberate erasure. The truth of his birth and early life is known to none but the Emperor himself, and even the most sanctioned archives of the Adeptus Terra hold only fragments, contradictory, forbidden, or declared apocryphal. Yet, among the oldest myths whispered by historians, scholars, and heretics alike, there endures one tale, the legend of the new man. Though dismissed by the ecclesiarchy as heretical speculation, this account claims to chronicle the first breath of the being who would become the master of mankind. A story half forgotten, half feared, but never fully silenced. Before the dawn of civilization, before the first stones of cities rose upon the soil of Terra, there lived those who were known as the shamans. They were the first human psychers, wanderers of spirit and wisdom, who walked the veil between the material world and the immaterium. In those distant Neolithic ages, the great powers of the warp had not yet fully formed. The foul gods of chaos slumbered unborn within these tides of unreality. Yet as humanity grew, learning, fighting, dreaming, the warp stirred in response. The thoughts and emotions of mankind rippled through the immaterium, feeding darker currents. Soon, the shamans began to lose what had once made them eternal, their ability to reincarnate into new lives. Upon death, their souls were devoured by predatory entities within the warp, and one by one, they began to vanish. Realizing extinction was near, the surviving shamans gathered in a great conclave, the last and most desperate of their kind. Together, they resolved upon a single act of sacrifice, to merge their souls into one, reborn as a single being who could guide and protect humanity through the coming ages. They called this being the new man. In solemn unity, the shamans took poison and died as one. Their souls entered the immaterium in a blinding surge of psychic brilliance, so powerful that the demons who sought to consume them were scoured by its purifying flame. From that conflagration of souls was born a single undying light, the one who would become the Emperor of mankind. A year later, in a Neolithic settlement among the herders and farmers of Anatolia, a child was born to an ordinary mother and father. He had brothers and sisters, and nothing about his birth seemed remarkable. Yet, the vast psychic power bound within his soul altered him, even in the womb, reshaping his very genome and rendering him immortal. He would never again need to reincarnate, nor could demons claim him upon death. As he grew, his powers awakened, quietly at first, then undeniably. He began to see beyond the material, to feel the pulse of life itself. When his father was murdered by his uncle, the boy's clairvoyance revealed the truth. Without hatred or sorrow, he used a mere thought to still his uncle's heart. It was then he understood. humanity required law, order, and wise rule if it was to ever fulfill its potential. Soon after, he left his village for the first great city of mankind, likely one of the ancient Sumerian settlements that would one day define Mesopotamia. Through the ages, the new man walked among his people. For 38,000 years, he wandered Terra, guiding humanity's rise in secret. At times, he was a farmer, a philosopher, a soldier, or a healer. In moments of crisis, he became a leader or messiah. In peace, he was the quiet counselor, the unseen hand behind progress. He taught governance, husbandry, science, and reason. Each lesson a stone laid upon the path to humanity's survival. But as mankind's achievements grew, so too did its excess. The extremes of the human soul, ambition, rage, pride, desire, fed the turbulence of the warp. From these emotions, the first stirrings of chaos took form. Khorne, the Lord of War, was the first to awaken, heralded by ages of bloodshed. Next came Tzeentch, rising amid the intrigues of nations and the webs of politics. Nurgle followed, his birth marked by plagues that swept across continents. By the end of Terra's Middle Ages, three ruinous powers were fully conscious. The fourth, Slaanesh, still slumbered, awaiting the decadence of the Eldari. Even as these gods stirred, they sensed the new man moving against them. They called him the Anathema, their natural enemy, and sought his undoing. The Emperor labored ceaselessly to restrain their influence. Yet even his wisdom could not silence the darker instincts within mankind's heart. Some of his efforts bore fruit, others sowed calamity. But still he endured, shaping the species toward a destiny only he could see. Countless ages later, during the height of humanity's first great age among the stars, the fabled age of technology, the immortal wanderer still lived. By then, he had met others like himself, perpetuals, humans gifted, or perhaps engineered, with unending life. Among them was Olivia Surika, who journeyed with him to the night world of Molech. There they discovered a warp gate leading directly into the realm of chaos. The future Emperor entered the gate alone. What transpired within is unknown, but when he emerged, he bore new power and forbidden knowledge, the means to create the Primarchs and the Astartes. In that moment, he secured the tools to shape humanity's empire, but also bound himself forever as the nemesis of the dark gods. Regardless of the true origins of the Emperor, they first appear in the Chronicles not as a savior, but as one warlord among many. One more iron-fisted ruler, carving territory from the chaos of the Age of Strife. In the late 29th millennium, the man who would later be called the Emperor of Mankind stepped into the open as a single, terrible fact among Terra's techno-barbarian chieftains. Beside him stood Malkador the Sigilite, friend and counselor. And together, they began the long, brutal campaign to bind the broken world under one will. Historians would later name those campaigns the Unification Wars. But the Emperor did not fight alone. He raised formations unlike anything seen before on Old Earth. Units such as the Geno 5-2 Chiliad, genetically enhanced troops who would later swell the ranks of the Imperial Army. And most terrible of all, the Thunder Warriors. Born not of careful childhood breeding, but of rapid adult augmentation. The Thunder Warriors were weapons in human form, more lethal than any space marine that would follow, forged through genetic, bionic, and chemical alteration. Their strength was raw and immediate. Their price, however, was high. Many could not survive the metabolic shock of their transformations. Many more, as the decades passed, fell prey to mental collapse, psychosis, rage, and the slow rot of instability. Still, it was these imperfect demigods who carried the Emperor to victory. They smashed the rival warlords and won the battles that made unification possible. By the time of the last great clash, recorded by some sources as the Battle of Mount Ararat in the Kingdom of Urartu, Terra at last knew a single rule. Centuries of blood and fire had delivered unity. A single planet with a single crown. But victory brought its own necessities. The weapons that had shaped the unification were ill-suited for peace. The Thunder Warriors' flawed biology and their tendency toward madness made them a mortal danger to a world that needed order rather than unpredictable titans. The Emperor judged that their continued existence would imperil the fragile unity he had forged. Reluctantly, and with grim calculation, he ordered their liquidation. The decision was not merely pragmatic. It was born of fear. Some chronicles claim that before the purge was complete, the Thunder Warriors realized the treachery of their maker, how he had driven them to monstrous strength, only to doom them to short, ruined lives, and they turned on him. In response, a cadre of custodians, numbered at several hundred and said to be commanded by the legendary Constantine Valdor, along with several thousand prototype Astartes of the fledgling First Legion, rose to defend the Emperor. They carried out a merciless culling of the obsolete Gene soldiers. Most of the Thunder Warriors perished then, cut down by those who had once fought beside them. A few escaped the slaughter. Some hid in anonymity among Terra's teeming millions. Small bands, like the self-styled Diet Tara, who would reappear during the Cerberus insurrection early in the Great Crusade, lived out bitter, forgotten lives, stripped of honors and haunted by the past. Imperial propaganda, eager to sanctify unity, declared the Thunder Warriors dead to the last man at Mount Ararat. Save for a single tragic figure, Eric Taranis, who the story said, survived only long enough to raise the Emperor's banner when victory was sealed. In truth, The stain of the culling could not be wholly erased. A handful of survivors would linger as ghosts in the Empire's shadow. Their existence a secret the Imperium did not bother to hunt, while the Great Crusade demanded all its attention. With Terra unified, the Emperor turned his eyes outward. Unity had been necessary, but it had not been the end. To secure humanity's future, he would build an engine to carry mankind across the stars. The years after Unity were given to preparation. He forged the Astropathic Service, astrotelepaths to bind his future dominion with psychic lines of communication, and conceived the Astronomicon, a lighthouse of pure will and psychic force, that, when lit by his power, would guide ships safely through the warp, over distances previously unthinkable. Yet the stroke that would most decisively shape the coming epoch was the Primarch Project. The Emperor moved to create 20 superhuman infants, molded upon his own genetic template, and designed to mature into generals, statesmen, and exemplars for a galaxy-spanning army. To ensure they would be beyond men, he drew upon the arts he had learned in the darker corners of the Immaterium. Crafts that could grant his creation extraordinary charisma and power, but that would also leave them vulnerable to the temptations of the warp. The ruinous powers could not abide such a scheme. Where the Emperor strove to unite and order the galaxy, the Dark Gods sought chaos and entropy. Their response was swift and metaphysical. The Primarchs were torn from their gestation in the Emperor's Himalayan gene labs and hurled into the warp. Despite the wards laid over the laboratories, the 20 were scattered across the galaxy, thought lost before they even drew breath. Unbowed, the Emperor carried on. From the genetic samples left behind after the Primarch's abductions, he commissioned a second, more practical creation. Warriors bred from the Primarch's gene seed and trained from adolescence for war. These were the Legions Astartes, the Space Marine Legions of the First Founding. Their Astartes were recruited from Terran boys, forged into transhuman warriors who would spearhead the conquest of the Sol System and beyond. Under the banners of these legions, the Emperor launched missions that would restore Imperial dominion in the inner system. Space Marines cleared slavers from the moons of Saturn and Jupiter. The crucial alliance with Mars, formalized in the Treaty of Mars in 739 M30, bound the Mechanicum to Terra, supplied the Imperium with technical might, material, and the cooperation necessary to expand outward. The Imperium of Man was more than conquest. It established the bureaucratic spine of an empire, integrating the Mechanicum within the newborn Adeptus Terra. When the warp storms finally abated after the coming of Slaanesh and the fall of the Eldari, the Great Crusade began in earnest around 798 M30. With the first pacification of Luna. Expeditionary fleets streamed outward, rediscovering lost human worlds, expelling Xenos overlords, and drawing thousands of planets into imperial compliance. In time, the Emperor's scattered sons were found. One by one, the Primarchs were reunited with their father, and with the Space Marine Legions born of their gene seed. Placed at the head of these legions, they helped to forge the Imperium into a galaxy-spanning dominion. The ideological core of that dominion was the Imperial Truth, a creed of reason, science, and militant atheism designed to choke the irrational roots of faith that fed the warp. The Emperor believed that superstition and priestcraft were the midwives of chaos. To rid humanity of the ruinous powers, he would cast down priests and burn temples. He declared that mankind would not be free to fulfill its destiny until the last stone from the last church was cast down onto the last priest. He personally witnessed the eradication of ancient religions on Terra, confronting cultists and holy men until the old superstitions lay in ashes. Yet the Imperial Truth contained its own iron law. Mankind must never again create machines of true thought. The memory of the men of iron, the thinking machines whose war had helped wreck the age of technology, haunted the Emperor. Artificial general intelligences, he believed, were a danger to the species' future. Thus, when the Crusade encountered human worlds that had resurrected thinking machines, their populations were exterminated rather than tolerated. The risk was deemed too great to allow reoccurrence. As the Great Crusade carved order from the wild edges of the galaxy, a new fear shadowed every triumph. Sorcery. The Emperor, greatest human psyker to ever live, watched the mutant psyker gene spread through the species and felt only cold ambivalence. Humanity, he judged, was not yet ready, neither in body nor in spirit, to master the warp without being mastered in turn. Again and again, Imperial hosts made planetfall to find populations enthralled by sorcerers, mystics who wielded gifts granted by demons. Such cults fought like cancers, and their arts resembled those practiced openly by the 15th Legion, the Thousand Sons of Primarch Magnus the Red. Opposition hardened. Mortarion of the Death Guard, who had learned on poisonous Barbarus what warp-born trickery could do to a people, condemned sorcery as an abomination. Leman Russ of the Space Wolves, for whom honor was measured in straight combat and unclouded courage, declared all slight and hidden arts dishonorable, and the Thousand Suns' practices intolerable. Their anger grew into a schism large enough to shake the newborn Imperium, and so the Emperor himself called a conclave to settle the matter, the Council of Nicaea. They gathered on that world in an ancient amphitheater packed with tens of thousands. The Emperor, enthroned above the dais, heard every case. The witch hunters, sisters of silence and their allies, recited a litany of suffering. Subjects broken by a warp thrall, psykers possessed and uncontrolled since the dawn of the Age of Strife. cults devouring reason, and mutants who had lost all claim to humanity. Across from them stood Magnus the Red, immense and terrifying to many, yet speaking with a Primarch's impossible charisma. Knowledge, he argued, is not tainted in itself. Mastery, not ignorance, made humanity safe. His thousand sons had learned to rule their power with study and discipline. Psykers could serve humanity rather than enslave it. He urged not prohibition, but research and guidance. The chamber split like iron under the hammer. Then a circle of Space Marine librarians approached the dais. With the Emperor's nod, a young epistolary spoke for them all. A psyker is like an athlete, gifted, needed training. Power was a tool that could serve light or dark. Sorcery, however, was something else. Knowledge bargained for in the warp. A transaction whose true beneficiary no one could ever know. Let psykers be strictly educated to serve mankind. Let sorcery itself be outlawed as unforgivable heresy. But Nicaea was also a trial. Magnus stood accused of practicing sorcery and of spreading its methods through the legions by helping institute the Librarius. Evidence mounted, the Emperor's wrath barely contained. He had entrusted Magnus alone with certain true secrets of the warp, binding him to forswear occult practice for the very dangers now set before the council. The confrontation between father and son was later recorded in the Grimoire Hereticus. Judgment fell hard. The Emperor rejected the librarian's compromise. Except for navigators and astropaths, properly trained, controlled, and essential, the Space Marine Legions would employ no psykers. Every Librarius was to be closed at once. Astartes, who possessed the gift, would return to battle line and forego their powers. A new office, the Space Marine Chaplain, was created to uphold the Imperial truth and guard Legion fidelity to the Emperor's command. Magnus was ordered again to abandon sorcery, incantation, research, all of it. He hated the decree, opposed it bitterly, and yet in the end, bowed to his father's will. The ruinous powers, though, had other plans. The path before Magnus and his thousand sons would grow far darker. So stood the edicts of Nicaea for the next 10,000 standard years. The Imperium's guiding law on human psychic mutation. Only one great reversal came in the age that followed the Horus Heresy. The ban on librarians within the Space Marines, and later within the Astra Militarum, was lifted. For that civil war proved beyond denial that sanctioned psykers were necessary to meet the power of chaos with strength of their own. Two standard centuries into the Great Crusade, the Emperor turned homeward to Terra to crown his designs for humanity. Beneath the vast and hostile desert in Asia, an artifact of the Dark Age of Technology waited, the Golden Throne. With it, he would open a path into the Eldari Webway and reshape that labyrinth into a human network. instantaneous transit between the worlds of the Imperium. The goal was nothing less than liberation. The webway bypassed the warp's predations. To travel within it was to deny demons their due. If humanity could be led into that shielded realm, if the webway's corridors could be extended and warded, then the need for warp travel could be severed entirely. Chaos would starve, cut off from the tides of fear and faith that powered its gods. Within that safety, guided by him, humanity would evolve into a fully psychic race, and rise to an eminence beyond even the fallen Eldari. Empire would knit to empire, distances would die, the Imperium would at last be truly one. Secrecy was essential. The throne, fashioned of an unknown, psychically reactive, gold-hued alloy, loomed above a pair of titanic doors of the same material. A portal vast enough for a warhound scout titan to stride through upright. It stood within the Imperial dungeon, the deepest foundations of the palace where once his gene seed labs had worked. There, hundreds of red-robed Mechanicum tech priests and servitors toiled while the Emperor enthroned held the webway gate open by his psychic might. Humanity could not replicate the webway's psychically resistant substance. The new human-built sections had to be shielded by the Emperor himself. That burden chained him to the throne. It was why he left the Crusade to others and returned to Terra in secret. But first, he set the board. After the Ullinor Crusade's extraordinary victory over the greatest orc war yet encountered, the Emperor judged his direct command no longer required at the front. Horus, first rediscovered among the Primarchs on Nir Cothonia, the only son to campaign beside his father for decades, was raised above his brothers. The Emperor and Horus had bled together, the Emperor sheltering his son at the siege of Relius, Horus repaying the debt at the Battle of Goro. The Emperor himself fell in Garkul Blackfang, an orc war boss who had held off three Primarchs before him. With such a bond, the choice seemed inevitable. The Emperor named Horus Warmaster and charged him to lead the Great Crusade in his stead. Then he turned inward. He founded the Council of Terra, the forerunner of the Senatorum Imperialis, established the Imperial Tithe, and expanded the civil engines of rule, the Adeptus Administratum, and more. With military command delegated and government broadened, he descended into seclusion beneath the palace to labor upon the Golden Throne and the Webway. But he told his sons little. The Primarchs watched the reins of power slip from the War Council to Terran nobility and bureaucrats that they despised. They saw their brother lifted above them and put into command. Ambition, pride, jealousy, the seeds took root. And in that restless soil, the dark gods found purchase. And from those first, quiet fractures, the horror of the Horus Heresy would one day break the galaxy in two. Not all of the Emperor's sons welcomed his new order. the Great Crusade's final years, the War Master Horus fell to chaos. The seduction had been arranged over long decades by Lorgar and his word-bearers, who sought a road where mortals could meet gods face to face. On countless human-settled worlds, the tale was old. The pilgrimage, a journey to a sacred place where divinity and flesh might mingle. Such a place did exist. It was the Warp, and its primordial truth was simple and terrible. The Immaterium was ruled by the Chaos Gods. Lorgar, driven by the pilgrimage of Lorgar, to test whether the gods of Colchis's old faith were real, sailed with the Serrated Sun Chapter and the 1301st Expeditionary Fleet to the edge of Imperial space. He had not yet fallen to chaos, but his faith in the Emperor had been broken 4 decades earlier at Kerr. There, the Emperor, arriving with Malkador the Sigilite, ordered the Ultramarines to raise Monarchia, a city that worshipped the Emperor as a god, and forced the word-bearers to their knees with psychic might. He declared them the one legion that had failed his purpose, spreading religion where the Imperial truth, atheistic and rational, must reign. Shamed and furious, Lorgar listened to Cor Ferran and Erebus, both already enthralled to the Warp, and resolved to seek gods worthy of mankind's devotion. Outwardly, the 17th Legion returned to the Crusade. In truth, they hunted fragments of the primordial truth, while 5 custodians, set by the Emperor to watch them, marked their every step. The trail led to the Cadia system, near the greatest warp storm of all, the Eye of Terror. Astropaths heard voices there. Chaos itself called Lorgar by name. The fleet descended to an uncharted world designated 1301-12. Imperial army troopers, word-bearers, custodians, and Legio Cybernetica Automata had made planetfall and found tribes of ragged, fearless humans. Barbarians whose violet eyes mirrored the eye's strange light. A woman stepped forward from the crowd and welcomed Lorgar Aurelian by name. This was Ingathel of Cadia, a priestess of chaos who would lead him toward enlightenment. Become the demon prince Ingathel the Ascended, and escort the scout vessel Orpheus Lament into the Eye. Within that storm of unreality, the serrated sun gazed upon the crone worlds, the cinders of the Eldari Empire. Ingathel lied artfully about Slaanesh's birth and the Eldari fall, claiming they failed because, at the height of their ascent, they refused the primordial truth. The Prince of Pleasure, she said, awoke unloved, and from that grief, the Great Eye was born. The lesson was pointed. Humanity, if it wished to live, must not repeat the Eldari sin. Humanity must accept chaos. The serrated sun returned to Cadia and reported all. Lorgar himself entered the Eye, received the Chaos God's favor, and returned as their chosen herald. He ordered a cyclonic bombardment that annihilated the world's original people and left the planet empty, so no one else could stumble upon the secret entrusted to him. Later, for its strategic value, the Imperium resettled Cadia in the 32nd millennium. Its new colonists, perhaps touched by proximity to the eye, developed the same violet eyes. From that revelation, the Word-Bearers were changed forever. First of the legions to worship chaos, and traitors in their hearts. They spent the Crusades' fading years enlightening humanity through manipulation and deceit, turning 9 Primarchs towards the gods' cause, foremost among them, Horus. When persuasion proved insufficient, Lorgar engineered events that would plunge the Imperium into war. Erebus, acting as Lorgar's blade, stole a Kynbrauch anathema, a chaos-tainted knife, from the Interrex during the Luna Wolves' brief contact with that advanced offshoot of mankind. On the moon of Davin, where the former governor Eugen Timba had raised a rebellion under Nurgle's shadow, the trap closed. Davin was a rotting fin of plague dead and shambling garrisons. In a final clash aboard his crashed warship, Timba wounded Horus with the anathema. Its venom was brewed by the Plague Lord himself, and even a Primarch's superhuman body could not cast it out. Erebus offered salvation. He brought the stricken War Master to the Serpent Lodge, a temple of chaos, whose priests promised a cure. In truth, they sent Horus's spirit into the Immaterium. There, guided by Erebus, the ruinous power showed him a vision. The Emperor had abandoned the Crusade to ascend to godhood, betraying his sons and the promise of the Imperial truth. The vision was a lie that would become true only through Horus's treachery. Believing it, he accepted Chaos' undivided aid and turned on his father. Half the Space Marine legions followed. In 7 standard years of war, beginning with the betrayals at Isfahan 3 and 5, the Horus Heresy tore the fledgling Imperium apart and slew billions. Its climax was the Siege of Terra. Demons and traitor legions battered the palace walls, while Primarch Sanguinius threw down the bloodthirster Ka-Banda. Loyalist relief fleets burned toward Sol. Time pressed. Horus lowered the void shields of his flagship, the Vengeful Spirit, inviting a final reckoning. Through all of this, the Emperor was bound to the Golden Throne. At the Heresy's outset, Magnus the Red, defying the edicts of Nicaea, had hurled his mind through the palace's wards to warn the Emperor of Horus's fall. The Emperor refused to believe him and condemned the sorcerer's transgression. Leman Russ and the Space Wolves were dispatched to bring Magnus to Terra, but Horus, having fallen to chaos, tampered with the order. Russ, enraged, unleashed his legion upon Prospero. The fall of Prospero in 4M31 broke the Thousand Suns and drove them, Magnus included, into Zinch's service to save their lives and their lore. Worse still, Magnus's warning had fractured the secret Imperial webway. Demons poured into the human-built tunnels. Custodians and Sisters of Silence fought like saints to hold the breach beneath the palace, but only the Emperor's will could keep the gate closed. Thus, Malkador the Sigilite and Rogel Dorn directed the war, while the Master of Mankind wrestled the portals of a labyrinth no human mind could master. He spoke across the void to Kai Zolain, a lowly astropath who had foreseen the heresy's end and the Emperor's fate. In those exchanges, the Emperor admitted he had known and accepted what must happen if his grand design failed. Corvus Korax came to Terra II, shattered by the drop site massacre. The Emperor, bleeding away strength to hold the webway, still poured the secrets of creating Astartes into his son's minds. Korax rebuilt the Raven Guard with accelerated methods, only to have the Alpha Legion corrupt the process. The 19th Legion joined the ranks of the Shattered Legions and played little part thereafter. 5 years on the throne had left the Emperor wan and failing. Blood drew lines from his nose, and even his visions showed fatigue to Tribune Ra Endymion, sensing the birth of the demon Drak Nian. He knew the war within the webway neared its terrible crescendo. He ordered 1,000 psykers gathered and sacrificed them to the throne to power it for a single solar day without him. Then he entered the webway himself. He swept the demons aside, confronted Drak Nian, and bound it within Ra Endymion's body, commanding the custodian to flee deep into the labyrinth so the creature could not touch humanity. Returning to the palace, he sealed the gate and became a prisoner to the throne once more. His great work was ruined. Without the webway, he told his followers, humanity would meet the same doom as the Eldari, whether in 1 year or in 10,000. Another war master of chaos would follow Horus. The Imperium was doomed, and for the first time, he confessed he no longer knew how to save mankind. With his attention fixed upon the breach, only when Malkador, second only to him in psychic might, took his place, could the Emperor leave the throne at all. When Horus dropped the vengeful spirit's shields, the Emperor understood the challenge. Malkador settled upon the golden throne to hold the portal. The Emperor mustered a strike force of Imperial Fists and Blood Angels and teleported aboard the enemy flagship. Warp-twisted sorcery scattered the attackers. Sanguinius reached the War Master first. In a duel of brothers, the Angel fell, but not before he opened a flaw in Horus's Terminator plate. The Emperor fought his way to the bridge. Horus, swollen with the combined power of all four Chaos Gods, stood as the champion of Chaos Undivided, while the Emperor remained mankind's last, unbending hope. Father and son clashed. Horus tore away the Emperor's arm and mangled his organs. The Emperor restrained himself, still loving the son he had raised. A lone custodian broke into the chamber. Horus turned and with a glance flayed him alive. In that instant of contempt for human life, the Emperor finally saw what Horus had become and what doom would follow his rule. He gathered the totality of his will and hurled it through the gap in the War Master's armor. The strike annihilated Horus's soul so utterly that even the Chaos Gods could not restore him. For a heartbeat before the end, the demon's grip slackened and Horace returned to himself, horrified at what he had done, and grateful to be freed, then vanished into motes of light howling through the warp. Brogledorn found the Emperor broken on the bridge and bore him back to the palace. Malkador, relinquishing the golden throne, crumbled to ash, mind and body burned out by holding shut the gate for the span of that final battle. Dying, the Emperor dictated a new purpose for the Golden Throne. Transform it into an arcane life support engine to hold him in an undying state between life and death. The machine would power the Astronomicon and hold chaos at bay, so long as the Imperium fed it the psychic essence of 1,000 psykers each day. His strength gone, the Emperor gave Dorn his last instructions. The throne's mechanisms engaged, and for more than 10,000 standard years, his body has lingered in unending stasis while his mind roams the Immaterium. Fighting to shelter humanity from the dark he always knew was coming. Since that ascension, he has never left the throne. What began as the nexus of a secret webway design became a life support reliquary and psychic projector, hurling the Emperor's mind through the warp to watch over his species and bar the way to the ruinous powers. The throne rests within the Sanctum Imperialis at the palace's heart, ringed by the companions of the Emperor, his elite Adeptus Custodes, intended by legions of Mechanicus Tech Priests who fight a losing war against time and failing knowledge. His body is preserved by incomprehensible machinery. His psychic essence is stretched across the galaxy, thin and luminous, guarding as best he can in this depleted state. Bound to the Golden Throne is the Astronomicon, the Imperium's great psychic lighthouse. From Terra, its telepathic beams pierce warp space, so navigators can steer voidcraft by its flame. The signal is guided by the Emperor's mind, empowered by a choir 10,000 psykers, selected, soul-bound to him, and set to their task only after brutal testing. Their life force burns in months. 1,000 die every day. The Adeptus Astra Telepathica's black ships must forever scour the stars for replacements. Most are indoctrinated to accept the duty their danger to others demands. Those who refuse are sedated and fed to the throne regardless. The Imperium endures, whatever the daily cost. It is said the Emperor's existence is unending pain, and only his devotion to humanity keeps him from embracing the release he longs for. If he dies, the Astronomicon gutters out. Safe warp travel, as the Imperium knows it, fails, and the realm fractures towards civil war. Some argue that humanity sailed the stars in the dark age of technology without him seated upon the throne. The point is fiercely debated. In truth, the Imperium's reliance upon his life and the faithful's resolve to preserve it have become the very foundation of his divinity in the hearts of uncounted billions. Only the Space Marine chapters refrain from worship. They remember dimly the man who shattered superstition and rejected his godhood, even as they revere him as founder and greatest of human leaders. Yet the era would not remain static. In 999 M41, Abaddon the Despoiler unleashed the 13th Black Crusade. Cadia fell. A great rift tore the galaxy, and one of the Emperor's sons returned. On Macrag, within the Temple of Correction, Rabute Gilliman was raised from stasis by the craft of Archmagos Dominus Belisarius Call, and the Death Guy Yenid's power. During the Terran Crusade, he entered the palace and spoke with his father for the first time in 10,000 years. None knows what passed between them. When Gilliman emerged, he became Lord Commander of the Imperium, de facto master of the High Lords, and launched the Indomitus Crusade, Primaris Space Marines at the Spearpoint, to shepherd his father's empire through the Noctis Aeterna. Even so, a darker clock ticked. Also in 999 M41, the Adeptus Mechanicus delivered a terrible confession to the High Lords and the Custodians. The Golden Throne's life support systems were failing, and the knowledge to repair them is lost. Without remedy or miracle, the Emperor's withered form will die. His mind and spirit will gutter like a candle in warp gale, and then the predators will feast. Irony rules the age of the Imperium. The one who strove to free humanity from superstition was worshipped as a god even before the heresy. Lorgar of the Wordbearers authored Electitio Divinitatis, arguing that no mortal could do what the Emperor had done: unite Terra's tribes and nations, reunite so much of the scattered galaxy, wield impossible psychic command and primal scientific understanding, and show such vast compassion. The text convinced many. Cults of emperor worship bloomed before the Great Crusade was done, taking the Lectitio as scripture and name. Under the imperial truth, such worship was a crime, the very heresy that led to Lorgar's humiliation on Kerr, and in time, to his turn toward the Chaos Gods. Lorgar later renounced the Lectitio Divinitatis for the tainted Book of Lorgar. But in the fires of the Horus Heresy, countless souls clung to the Emperor as salvation. Their faith seemed to shield them against demons, and the cult spread. Only the Adeptus Astartes refused to kneel, honoring him instead as exemplar of human potential, an obstinacy that still sparks conflict with ecclesiarchy and Inquisition alike. At the heresy's end, the Emperor's broken shell was bound within the throne so his mind could anchor in matter while it expanded throughout the warp, at last encompassing nearly the full span of the Imperium. Across centuries, worship widened. By the 32nd millennium, those scattered cults were fused into the Imperial cult, its teeming trillions served by the Adeptus Ministerium, the Ecclesiarchy, after the High Lords recognized it as the state faith. The Emperor became, in truth and title, the God Emperor. His will, interpreted by the Senatorum Imperialis, his laws enforced by the Adeptus Arbites, his body and palace guarded by the Custodians, his Astartes, the Imperium's sword, and the Inquisition born from his command to Malkador, grew into a power unto itself, hunting threats within and without. Despite his protests in life, the pressure of trillions of believing minds has wrought its own reality in the Immaterium, where thought and faith shape the world. The Imperial Creed teaches that his entombment freed his spirit to guide and protect humanity more directly, unbound by flesh. Thus, the skull, a sign of his self-sacrifice, became the Imperium's icon. Whatever he once was, he is now a god within the warp, equal to any single Chaos power, perhaps to all four combined. The greatest spiritual force for order in the Milky Way. As long as the throne sustains even the faintest breath, he maintains the Astronomicon's light, though that light demands the lives of 1,000 Psykers each day. Through the throne's amplification, he still touches the world. Cryptic edicts in the Emperor's Tarot, visions and dreams granted to the faithful strong enough to hear, blessings that blunt Chaos's claws, and other intercessions whispered of in 1,000 hagiographies. Many believe the warp storm called the Storm of the Emperor's Wrath, which ripped across the Ultima Segmentum during the Age of Apostasy, was his anger made manifest at Goge Vandyre's usurpation. Others attest that his presence alone holds Chaos at bay. Remove him, and the galaxy becomes an eye of terror without borders. Among the Inquisition's highest, it is said he can, with the Sanctum Imperialis itself, bend reality, slowing time, even halting its arrow. And yet, the God Emperor is tormented, unable to walk among his people. He is horrified at what the Imperium has become. Stability bought with stagnation, repression, exfoliation, xenophobia and zealotry. The evils he sought to end have multiplied over 10 millennia. Still, he endures, for his death would cripple the Imperium and strip humanity of both his guidance and his ward. He fears that without him, humanity will not survive. So he permits the Imperium to persist in its degraded form. Sometimes, rarely, he works through chosen servants to ease the human lot, kindling embers of hope as the time of ending draws near and the Golden Throne winds down like a broken watch.